Happy Friday, everybody. I want to welcome all of you to the Michael Cutler Hour. My name, appropriately enough, is Mike Cutler, and this is Friday. It's February the 17th. I hope all is going well in your world. Always good to join you at the end of the week to talk about a bunch of issues, but as you know, I generally focus my attention on immigration and the impact that it has on our world, specifically on national security, criminal justice, the economy, the environment, healthcare, education, you name it. By not enforcing our immigration laws, by not securing our borders, every one of those critically important challenges is getting hammered. One of my goals is to bring you guests, people who will provide unusual perspectives. And today, in fact, rather than go off on a monologue, as I sometimes do, or a rant, perhaps more appropriately, I've got an interesting person that's going to join us today. His name is Don Crescetti. Don Crescetti worked for the INS for a number of years. He was involved with the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, and his focus was on the frauds program. Now, those of you who are familiar with me and what I've said when I've been before Congress and when I appear in the national media, I've been very critical about the issue of immigration benefit fraud. It's not just the borders that create the problems for us. It's the immigration system. So let's bring Don Crescetti on and introduce him to all of you. Don Crescetti, how are you?
Hi, Michael. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. You're a little bit distant, but I can hear you. Are you on speakerphone?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
How about now? Does that sound better?
That sounds a little bit better, yes. More betterer, as I might have said when I was a kid. I welcome you to the program, Don. And why don't I start out by letting you tell my audience who you are and what you've been up to.
Sure. A little bit of background. I'm an immigration weenie, go back to the mid-70s. Started out in the Legacy INS Immigration Officer Corps as an inspector and an examiner.
By the way, just to interject, the term legacy, we use that term because when they created DHS, they merged a bunch of agencies together. But prior to that, the INS was a standalone agency. So those of us who were involved with the immigration business, as it were, prior to the creation of DHS, look back at those years and at the agency, and we refer to it as the Legacy INS. Just to clarify for those of you who might not be familiar with the jargon, now that we're, I guess, close to 10 years into the DHS, or I guess 9 years into the DHS.
Yes, into the ninth year now.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I just wanted to make sure that everybody knows what's going on.
No problem. Bottom line is I have 36 years in the immigration arena. I entered the field of management back in the mid-80s in the field as an assistant district director, being responsible for all the programs in a normal legacy immigration naturalization service operation, which included inspections, examinations. That term today is called adjudication, so that's the benefits, the services side of the house. Records and information, investigations, detention and deportation. Of course, they have different titles now under ICE as well. In about the mid-90s, after numerous stints to headquarters as a special assistant to the couple commissioners and detailed to a number of field offices as a troubleshooter, as an acting director and the things, I then was promoted to that of an associate commissioner in examinations, responsible for the adjudications, the naturalization, the records, and included at that time inspections, air, land, and seaports of entry, and the administrative appeals office. I was there for about 5 years and then returned to the field as a district director, again, then responsible for a legacy INS operation of examinations, inspections, investigations, deportation. And then, as luck would have it, INS is abolished in 2003, and then Homeland Security is created. So the first 6 months, as the agencies, mostly Customs and Legacy INS, were trying to figure out what employees go where and everything, I was detailed to the Eastern Region up in Vermont to be the interim regional director for 6 months to assist in the transition. And then after 6 months, I was reassigned to headquarters to investigate and research the gap, the void that was left by abolishing INS and separating enforcement and services. And then, as most of our callers should or may know, what is in today, the legacy customs and INS investigators were consolidated into ICE, along with detention and deportation officers, that program, and intelligence. And then the legacy agency inspectors and the Border Patrol was consolidated into what is called Customs and Border Patrol, leaving the benefits services program that back under legacy INS was called examinations,
I think, by the way, to interrupt this for a sec, I think you should
USCIS.
Explain what benefits really means. I think people may not understand the issue of benefits. So why don't we just give them
benefits,
an overview about what the benefits program is.
Immigration benefits in the sense of people who are applying to come into the country, whether it be temporarily or permanently, whether it be to unite with a relative, say a mother, father, parent, child, sibling, relationship of a U.S. citizen or married.
In other words, acquire lawful status, an immigrant visa or U.S. citizenship
cards,
would be good examples.
Yeah. Permanent or temporary work visas. Perhaps they're alleging persecution, so they're seeking asylum.
Right.
That is, for the most part, there. And naturalization, of course, once you're in the country for at least 3 to 5 years, certain individuals are allowed to apply for naturalization, so naturalization as well. So that's the benefits side of the house.
Basically,
so,
the keys to the – you could say you were the locksmith there, the keys to the kingdom.
One could say most people that come into this country have to go through the immigration benefits side of the house that is now USCIS, U.S. Citizenship, United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, and have to have a petition approved of some sort. It's a very critical point. I would say that is a key. That's a good analogy. And then you have to go through the gatekeepers, which I would say, analogy-wise, would be CBP at air, land, and sea ports of entry.
Mm-hmm.
Some people require a visa before they come, so you go to the State Department and get the visa, but most of those require a pre-approved petition that would have had to been filed and adjudicated by USCIS.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of summarizes that. And so anyway, asked me to come in and look, hey, how are we going to do in a post-911 environment in the adjudication, immigration benefits side of the house without enforcement and intelligence? So after several months of research, some critical documents that I came across that helped me eventually come up with what became known as fraud detection and national security was a general accounting office report that had been done, actually formally released in January 2002, but after at least a one-plus year review. So even GAO at that time, no one knew INS was going to be abolished. And I also used the 911 Commission report. Now, those two reports are critical as to what led to what created FDNS. The GAO report found that legacy INS never truly had a sound anti-fraud strategy or policy, that they didn't even have the system to track the types and kinds of fraud, that INS could not even quantify nor qualify the fraud that existed. They also found that there was an innate conflict, schizophrenia, if you will, two sides of the house that conflicted with one another, that being enforcement and the other being services, and that depending on, which way the wind was blowing at any given year, which party was in power, depended as to whether there was more of a concentration and focus on enforcement or services, and that often changed with administrations. So I took that report, and of course, it's one of the only GAO reports, and every time I say this, the GAO accountants and others laugh and say they must have done something wrong, but it's the only report I've ever read that I agreed with 100%.
And the GAO folks is the General Accountability Office. They're basically the investigative arm of the U.S. Congress.
Yes, yes. And they're absolutely right. So what we did is we came up with an anti-fraud strategy working closely with our ICE partners. And that was quite challenging because, you know, you're dealing with a new department that doesn't really have any immigration experts at the headquarters level in DHS. We're working with another brand new agency.
Stop. I'm holding up a stop sign. You're talking about how there were no people at headquarters with immigration experience. Now, this is something that's very interesting because I've testified before perhaps four or five congressional hearings just on that issue. The fact that they merged immigration and customs together, and yet the people that were running the show at immigration, for the most part, came out of legacy customs with no immigration background.
That's actually not what I was alluding to, but it is something I was going to get to. What I was talking about, they created Department of Homeland Security. So they had to create this new headquarters, not INS, not Customs, but a brand new headquarters, find a facility, staff it, get people. And what we learned the first couple years as they did that, and it's understandable. I mean, this isn't meant to be criticizing.
Well, I have to be honest with you. Slow down. I don't understand it, and I'll tell you why I don't understand it. Because you had thousands of people working for legacy INS, but yet very often they were ignored because, in my judgment, and this is what I've told Congress, and this is what I told the 9/11 Commission, immigration was something they would rather not have had to deal with at all. Because
it seemed
as though immigration was an afterthought, was an impediment to commerce. Look at the expansion of the visa waiver program. Time and again, what we have seen is an unwillingness from both political parties to secure our borders really, other than to create illusions and enforce the immigration laws in any meaningful way. You know, right now, back when I was in New York, we had fewer than 100 INS agents prior to 9/11. And back then, we had about 2,000 immigration agents for the whole country. New York City Police Department has between 35 and 40,000 cops, depending on where we are in any given time with the budget and so forth. The TSA has over 60,000 people. Immigration, on the other hand, had 2,000 people, and it covered the entire United States of America. I think the FBI back then had 16,000 FBI agents, and they shared their responsibility, their statutory responsibility, with other federal agencies and with local agencies. Immigration was an empire unto itself. If immigration didn't arrest an illegal alien, nobody else was going to. And yet the government thought it was adequate to have 2,000 agents enforcing the immigration laws from within the interior of the United States at a time when no other agency would even get involved with those violations of law. So I don't know if I really agree with you that it was understandable. I find a lot of it isn't understandable. I think that's how we got into the mess that we're in today, to be very honest with you, Don.
Well, it's not that we agree or disagree. We're talking kind of about talking past each other about two different things.
Well,
but
you're
right.
I want to make sure that we don't gloss over how we got into the crisis that we find ourselves in today.
Okay, but that's not what I was talking to. But if we go back to what you're talking about, what led up to the abolishment of INS, if you look at the immediate events that took place, you're talking about a terrorist attack. And INS had been going through, I don't know for how many years, at least a good 5 to 7 years of constant criticism by the Hill, by the media, about how dysfunctional they are. And this all tracks back to what you're saying is, I mean, we had an agency with a major undertaking, but we're never funded and never given the laws that we needed.
And let me ask you another question.
To do our job. So
you're
talking about the
2001 attacks. Were we not attacked once but twice in 1993?
Right. And Muhammad Atta, that's the key thing. Many say that what broke the camel's back with regard to the straw that broke the camel's back that led to the abolishment of INS, that finally pushed Congress over the edge to legislate the abolishment of INS and the creation of Homeland Security, was that Muhammad Atta, after the terrorist attack and after his and the other terrorists' death, the school received a notice that Legacy INS benefit side had granted his change of status from a visitor to a student.
Yep, and in fact, it was also Marwan Al-Shehhi and I testified at that congressional hearing with Commissioner Ziegler.
Right, but let me point out, and it's not the purpose of your call, but I want to point out that that is factually incorrect. And I remember I was associate commissioner at the time. I did my best to get the news producers at CNN and Fox to clearly understand that the notice that the school received about Muhammad Atta was not a change of status. That had been done prior to 911, that what they got was simply their record copy, their file copy of what had been done many months earlier.
But I'm just pointing out,
it's a fact. The news producer specifically told me, we know that, but that's not glitzy. That doesn't sell news.
But there's another problem, too. There was no reason, and there's still no reason, why a company had to be contracted to issue those letters, which is what we really wound up with. When I was an adjudications officer, at no cost to the government, I would handwrite a piece of correspondence telling an alien that their application had been denied or approved, dropped it off in the mailroom on my way out of the office. And suddenly immigration, for whatever reason, decided that they needed to spend millions of unnecessary dollars, in my judgment, to get a contractor, I believe down in Texas, who would handle all of the correspondence for the agency rather than do it the old-fashioned way and simply have somebody put an envelope in the mail who would handle the case.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of what the problem was.
Yeah, and I'm not going to tell you whether I support contracting out or not, but I will tell you that the bureaucratic reason why so many agencies started contracting out is because some years ago we were given positions that are called FTEs, full-time equivalencies.
Mm-hmm.
And when you were given those positions, you had to live within those positions. So you had to hire, train, and keep those positions filled. You may have had enough in your budget to hire more, but you couldn't because your authorized level was X. So what we started to do, many agencies throughout government, is you could use your general expense money to get some part-time contract support because you didn't have to pay for the benefits and all that stuff, and it was temporary. That's what led to most of the contract. I just wanted to give it a little history there.
I understand, but it became such an arcane way of doing business.
Yeah, but if I'm dying and I'm overwhelmed and I don't have enough immigration personnel and I got an opportunity to hire a couple few people that can help those poor, overwhelmed souls get files, you know, send records out and things like that, my goodness, it's just the most effective, efficient thing to do. But that's all we're going to do on that. We're going off track here a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, in creating the FDNS, we couldn't really do much because it was a new headquarters. They didn't really have many, if any, subject matter immigration experts there yet. We couldn't create new positions. We didn't know who was going to get personnel. We had this thing called shared services. And of course, one of the things we learned the first several years is you can't share. Of course, that changes after a while. But we had to come up with a real quick solution to what we were going to do with all these applications and petitions coming in. Well, we've known for years they're right with fraud, but now we don't have a program responsible for it. So looking at that GAO report, we used it to build the framework of what a year later was actually named FDNS, but it was mostly focused on the fraud. And we worked out an arrangement with ICE where it would be a dual strategy. It would be administrative and criminal. And that if the case was accepted for criminal investigation, obviously the objective there would be to prove the fraud, indict them, prosecute them, convict them, incarcerate them, and then after they serve their sentence, remove them. So we're talking about years and a lot of money and time to do that and resources. And then on the cases that weren't investigated or prosecuted criminally, which were the majority, because the majority is the lower level one-party, two-party fraud that most AUSAs, assistant U.S. attorneys, won't even accept for a federal prosecution. It's lower level. So that left, of course, well, who's going to do all the lower level fraud? So we worked out an arrangement that CIS, through what we then named Fraud Detection and National Security, would be responsible for taking the lead on detecting the fraud, referring it to ICE, and if ICE didn't want to accept it for a criminal investigation, CIS would do it through its FDNS officers. And of course, the first 2 years, we only had 100. So you're talking, you talk about all your number of New York NYPD police officers and then INS agents. We only had 100 FDNS officers, and the overwhelming majority of the fraud cases were lower level. But over a period of years, and I'll get into that in a little bit, but what we learned about a year later was that the volume was so great that ICE no longer wanted us to refer 100%. They didn't want to have to look at everything. So we reached an agreement with regard to the new referral criteria, and it pretty much being consistent with prior years with U.S. attorney's offices, which is if it's multiple conspiracy, a major a multi-party fraud crossing state lines, involving criminal activities, perhaps other criminal actions, perhaps even having national security connotations, those cases would be referred to ICE. Not to mean they would accept all of them, but they would be referred, and if they didn't act, accept or decline within 60 days, FDNS would assume jurisdiction.
Let me back up. What was the criteria? In other words, you weren't looking at onesies. You were looking more at fraud rings, basically?
No, FDNS was looking at all the fraud. And,
right.
And the first 3 years, we were referring all the suspected fraud to ICE. In fact, ICE had developed benefit fraud units, partners for us to work with. And the legacy INS regional investigations programs became the ICE benefit fraud units that would work with FDNS. So we would refer 100% of the suspected fraud. But what happened over a period of 1 to 3 years is we detected so much they couldn't handle it. So we modified the criteria to be multi-party fraud and that the onesies and twosies would not be referred.
Here's the problem, and I understand why they did that. And I had this conversation with Mike Chertoff, and we both spoke up at Chapman Law School, of course, Mike Chertoff being the former Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. That means that if, let's say, for argument's sake, a terrorist gets involved in a marriage fraud but introduces himself to the girl, maybe he's working somewhere and he finds some hapless female and convinces her either for money or fools her into believing he loves her, into marrying her, that investigation is not going to be conducted because it's a single-issue case. Is that correct?
Well, there are some exceptions. I mean, if you're able to link a one- or two-party fraud case to something more of a larger criminal activity, yeah, it's possible.
But if you can't, then you're not going to be looking at those individuals.
Well, no, we look at them all.
What I mean by look at it is... You're not referring it because they're going to look at this, and if you don't at that point realize that the guy is involved with terrorism, no one is going to pay attention because it's a single-issue case.
Absolutely not. And I was getting into this, but you would.
Okay, I'm sorry.
So the criteria, the cases that didn't meet the referral criteria were then opened, investigations were opened by FDNS.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's an administrative investigation. The difference being, when we open an administrative investigation, the primary objective is to validate or invalidate the suspicion of fraud. If a fraud finding is found, to prepare the investigative report, provide it to the adjudicators, to deny the petition, then place the individual in removal proceedings. We would then take that data and enter it into our newly developed Fraud Detection and National Security Database, which was one of the critical findings of Legacy INS by GAO. So we built an analytics-based fraud detection national security database. And we also post lookouts and text so that that individual, once you find fraud, if they ever try to file again, they travel, they apply for a visa, there will be a text hit and we would identify them. Now, this is going to get to your exact question. As we conduct an administrative fraud investigation, if during that investigation we disclose more egregious criminal activities or any type of national security issue, the administrative investigation is closed and it's immediately referred to ICE.
I understand. That makes sense.
Okay.
But here's my question for you, because I don't know that you've ever been a field agent, but I know as a field agent, many times, and the term they like to use is randomness. By randomness, by dumb luck, getting the right case at the right time. As a brand new agent, they never would have assigned the case to me because there was no indication of anything. Within my first 8 months as an agent, I was given a guy who had an altered visa. He committed visa fraud on the document. And it turned out that he was here to get the money to buy explosives to blow up an oil refinery in Israel. He was part of a terrorist plan. I tripped over this guy by dumb luck. And the idea that I'm getting at, and I know that you don't have the resources, but because of the lack of resources, individual fraud cases, unless in advance you understand that there's something else going on, is generally not going to become the focus of anybody's attention. Now, I think part of the problem is the lack of manpower. How many agents, for example,
have? Michael, no. We detect and investigate every suspected fraud case. The issue isn't whether we look into it. The issue is who's going to look into it.
All right, but so now here's my question, though. Here's my question. Beyond the interview, I presume that everybody gets interviewed where an I-130, by the way, folks, is the application that is filed by a spouse for their alien husband or wife so that that alien could then get a green card. So my question is every I-130 that's filed result in an interview?
Well, first of all, let me back up and explain an I-130. An I-130 is an immigrant relative petition that isn't just marriage-based. It's also for brother, sister, mother, father.
I'm talking about the marriage-based.
Okay. Now, the marriage cases, if the individual is in the United States, because not all beneficiaries of marriage visa petitions are in the country.
Right.
But
and
if
then
they're
be
in the
done
country,
by State Department overseas at an embassy
particularly if they're in the country, and as you know, most of them are married to U.S. citizens, then they apply for green card, permanent residence with the visa petition.
Mm-hmm.
And those people are all interviewed.
They're all interviewed?
Yes.
Okay, and that was my question.
There is a loophole. There's a little vulnerability here, and it's an issue that FDNS it continues to pursue now, is that when the petitioner is in the United States and the beneficiary is abroad, as a rule, the policy does not require interviews of the petitioner. The logic being, what good would it be because the beneficiary is abroad? And I would actually disagree with that logic. And
I disagree with that logic. So we had that problem when I was an I-130 examiner way back when we had the title examiner. I was detailed for a year back in the 70s doing those interviews. And I agree, they should be interviewed.
Yeah. In fact, what we've been seeing in FDNS, because we also conduct benefit fraud assessments, which have never been done. We take random samplings of pending, approved, completed, denied cases, and we go out, for example, with marriage fraud, go out and see if they're still married. We did that with religious workers. We did it with H-1B, L-1Bs, and it's never been done in our legacy INS. So we've done a number of things focused on enhancing integrity of the legal system that have absolutely never been done. And in the marriage fraud arena, what we basically found is today's fraudsters, if you will, mm-hmm. are very much more creative and educated. And it's no longer the real simple marriage fraud. Many of them are being trained. They're preparing for interviews. They're preparing. Many of them are even living together for a prolonged period of time to survive the interview, to get to know the person, even though there isn't an intent to stay with that person. It truly isn't for love and family unity and all that. But to stay with them and live with them and not necessarily in the same bedroom and all those types of things, but to certainly have it structured that way should ICE or FDNS come knocking on the door. But they're really understanding the need to know that person because you're about to be grilled by an immigration adjudicator, and you better be able to answer the question.
I tell you what, I could certainly attest to
it. And that's a hard nut to crack, Michael.
I'll tell you what, when we first started out, the guy would tell you that he lived in the basement of an apartment house, and the woman would say that she lived in a private home. I mean, it was amazing. And over time, even back in the 70s, you saw a greater and greater level of sophistication. And in fact,
well,
we were involved with a case.
Having done it.
We were involved with a case.
Having done it under INS and having done it CIS and now with the advanced technologies and people getting just smarter and you know, it's more and more.
But here's my question. All right. I understand what you're saying. I'm telling you, I've been there. In fact, I was involved with a case where I identified an individual who had gotten involved in a marriage fraud. The attorney turned out to be the marriage arranger. It was almost humorous. He was hooking up Chinese seamen who would jump ship with young ladies, primarily who were Hispanic of Puerto Rican background in New York. They didn't even speak a common language. The attorney was ultimately successfully convicted. It was my first stint on the witness stand in federal court back in 1977, I believe that was. But here's the question that I have. I'm looking at an ICE news release, and I don't know. You know, what I look at here is a Brazilian couple sentenced in a $55 million fraud scheme. There was another case where an attorney, I believe that he was claiming to be a practicing rabbi, fled to Canada, where they said that he had processed or was involved with 25,000 aliens over a period of 10 years who got visas, in some case by marriage fraud and labor certification fraud and so forth. And nothing in the ICE press release indicated that any effort was being made to go after these thousands of illegal aliens who got status in the United States by lying. They were co-conspirators. So the ICE press release, which touts what great work we're doing, we got the arranger. Meanwhile, you've got 25,000 people floating around out there, and he was doing this over a period of 10 years. So I find that disturbing, because we don't have the resources to go after the folks that were actually co-conspirators.
Yeah, like most criminal prosecutions, as you know, having been an agent, the U.S. Attorney's Office is going to focus on the conspirators themselves.
But what about the administrative perspective? Because what we used to do
was
we would go after the aliens and we would make sure that we did everything possible to locate them and at least seek their deportation from the United States. And apparently they're not doing that now.
Right. But, you know, Is that the case?
Well, that's what I'd like to know.
The thousands, if not millions, depending on how many years we're talking about, of the small fish are out in the ocean.
Michael,
let me finish. I'm going to get to your question. It's just not practical to think that you can do all that. But the policy and procedure is that when ICE finishes their prosecution in their case, and in fact, up until throughout that time, they have FDNS officers working with them, and all the other individuals, the smaller fish, if you will, that benefited from the fraud rings, have been identified. Their files and petitions have been retrieved, and they're in a service center where, depending on what type of fraud it is, if it's employment based, it's in one center. If it's a marriage fraud based, it's in another center. They're in the queue for the centers to look at those cases, review each one to determine what action's going to be taken. And then, most of the actions are going to end up being initiating revocation proceedings, placing them in removal proceedings.
On paper, but is anyone – stop right there. I have a question. This is the question that I got Al D'Amato to ask at a hearing when Al Nelson was the commissioner. And my question is, it's fine to do it on paper and say, look at that. We used to take credit for so many removal proceedings initiated where we had no idea where the alien was. It was done in absentia.
Well, that's part of the problem. By the time it gets there –
So what I'm asking
for
my audience's sake, because I'm giving you as much opportunity to explain your side, but I'd like to have a conversation with you. And what I want to ask you is if, in fact, a lot of these cases are done on paper when nobody looks for the warm body.
Well, you have to initiate the revocation proceeding.
Yeah, but is anyone then looking for the warm body after the fact?
They're not law enforcement officers. They can't.
And that's the point I want to make. And that's why I have been really torqued that we have 60,000 plus people at TSA going after passengers, 85-year-old women. But you have aliens that we know have committed fraud to game the immigration benefits program, and there's no manpower allocated to go after those people.
Yeah.
Now that to me.
Well, now look at the priorities too. If I just would add, in today's environment where the priority is on criminal aliens, and if I'm not mistaken, there's a review going on to determine what to do with the non-criminals that are currently
give them employment authorization. Apparently, according to the policy memos,
overwhelming the immigration courts.
The administration, if I'm not mistaken, has issued policy statements saying that they're going to give them employment authorization because they're not a priority. And by the way, a criminal alien could be an alien who has only been convicted. So if you have the Teflon Don, remember John Gotti was prosecuted how many times? Until an alien is convicted, it doesn't matter if he's been on trial 20 times. If he has no convictions for immigration purposes, he's not considered a criminal alien. So we have
to have an alien
who's been convicted of a felony before ICE is willing to take action against that alien.
I'm not blaming you for this.
I'm blaming the system, by the way, Don.
So now let's go back to the question and your issue. Well, if they're not convicted criminals and they're not within the ICE or the immigration court priority schema, what do you think's going to be done with them?
Absolutely nothing.
Right.
And that's wherein lies the problem. Because you know what we've done now? Is we have told the terrorists how to embed themselves in our country. They are basically being told, if you come to America, even if you run the border, and you know we have Iranians right now living in Venezuela, the CUDs, the shock troops, okay? And if they come here, they could easily claim to be from Latin America if they've been living there for 10 years and acquire the language and so forth. As long as they're not arrested by the police or other law enforcement and they're not convicted, no one's going to give a darn that they're here. And that's a problem. And I don't blame you, but I blame a lack of political will. It's both sides of the aisle. This
well,
is how we
get
got
a
into
chance,
this mess in
I know
the first place.
We only have 25 minutes left, but if we get a chance, I'd like to talk about some potential solutions.
I just want to ask you one other case
to
give you an example of the kind of thing that drives me up a wall. And I'm going to guess you're the guy I could ask about this. And I wrote about it. And it's a specific case you may not know about him, but I think he's emblematic of the problem we have. I'm looking at a Department of Justice press release, and it was done under an ICE press release before that. A guy by the name of Samuel Abrahali Fezhassian. He's an Eritrean national, and they find him smuggling aliens, 23 years old. And they indicate in the press release that this was a guy who came to the United States illegally, and we gave him political asylum just 3.5 weeks after he applied for it. He claimed that he was running for his life in Eritrea. I can't imagine anyone did a field investigation in 3.5 weeks. They give him political asylum. Turns out he was actually in Guatemala smuggling Africans from Africa through Central America into the United States. The thing that disturbs me was there was no indication of anything being done now to revoke his political asylum or prosecute him for committing fraud on the application. So even if he gets 5 years in jail for alien smuggling, if he still has political asylum, you and I both know they're not going to try to deport this guy. So
my point is that we need to see this as a
coordinated system where this sort of thing gets addressed. And I don't think you would argue with me, would you?
No, I agree 100%. And while I don't know anything about the case, over the past several years, I've had experience with similar cases, including asylum and refugees that ended up being known or suspected terrorists. So
right.
I can tell you.
And that's why I'm concerned about this, precisely.
Now, of the cases that I have been involved in, that has not been my experience. In fact, they have worked very closely with CIS, FDNS, because we now have FDNS officers on better than 30-some JTTFs. We're at the National Counterterrorism Center with the FBI Terror Screening Center. I mean, we're all over the place.
And that's where they should be, and I agree with it, because, you know, what most people don't realize is terrorists are more likely to be charged with visa fraud or immigration benefit fraud than terrorism. Am I right or wrong in what I just said?
But here lies the rub.
Okay.
In many of the national security cases, including known terrorists, most of them, by the way, they call them KSTs, known and suspected terrorists. Most, by the way, fall under the S, suspected. All right? Now, even the known, there is either insufficient evidence to indict for that activity, and or the information is classified and you cannot use it, and or the investigation is not yet completed. So in situations similar to what you mentioned, I can almost guarantee you that the FBI, ICE, and CIS through its FDNS have been all working together. But depending on the circumstances, like the ones I just mentioned, will determine what has been or is being done. And some of these cases, this is where the FDNS has become such a value. The FBI came to us and said, we're changing our policy. We want you, a non-law enforcement agency, on our joint terrorism task forces. And one of the reasons is, quite often, and you're going to really appreciate this, having been an INS agent years ago, is that we can often find some sort of lead that will take us down the path of immigration fraud that we can use formally and deny and initiate proceedings without even saying the national security word.
Right.
And that is being done very actively. So I can tell you, it's a different world now than it was pre-911, and it's a different world than it was even 3 years ago. The agencies have advanced that much in finally recognizing the value of information sharing and collaboration to the point of exchanging resources, including staff and systems,
And I agree, but again, I'll come back and tell you that they're still lacking enough manpower. How many applications did you process?
Oh, I don't disagree with you. We have further to go than how we've come, but it's a different world, Michael. It really
is. And I'll tell you what, this is good cop procedure. You know, when I was with the Drug Task Force, and I worked with the JTTF, I've arrested a number of terrorists in my career. And I'll tell you, the immigration fraud charges were tremendous. Or even going after somebody for reentry after deportation to get them off the street because you were hoping to flip the guy using an immigration charge.
Well, look what happened after 9/11. The FBI didn't have Title VIII authority to hold people for immigration reasons, which they quickly got it afterwards.
Well, they always wanted it. And I think part of what happened, though, too, to be honest about this, is I think that there were enough instances where immigration had dropped the ball, where the FBI was able to say, listen, if we were on board, this wouldn't have happened. And I think that's part of it. They always wanted Title VIII. Whenever I worked with the Bureau and I had a desk at the FBI, they always coveted Title VIII. Title VIII, for you folks out there, by the way, is the Immigration and Nationality Act, the body of law that regulates the entry and continued presence of aliens in the United States. And the FBI always knew this was an invaluable tool. So I think that what happened after 9/11, when they looked at the screw-ups and so forth, I think it added to to the case that they were making that they needed to be on board with Title VIII also.
Yeah, and a simple way to really explain the difference is with Title VIII and enforcing immigration laws, it's kind of a lower standard, if you will, from criminal cause and arrest as far as how long you can detain somebody and all those types of things. Well, administratively, for Title VIII authority, once we determine alienage, and if you're in this country in violation of law, you're in custody, or you could be in custody.
And basically, to sum it up real easy, because it was funny, this became an issue when I was an expert witness at a criminal trial in Hawaii. The difference between administrative immigration law and criminal law is all about the goal. Administratively, if an alien violates the law, you're simply seeking the removal of that alien from the United States and perhaps stripping him or her of the green card or their lawful status. Could even be U.S. citizenship if they lied on their naturalization application. Criminally, it's like any other crime. You're looking for a conviction and the imposition of a punishment, whether it's a jail sentence, a fine, or both. And sometimes the way it works is you get the criminal charges, and after you come out of jail, then the administrative side kicks in. And then that same alien is put before an immigration judge for a removal or a deportation hearing.
Right.
And I hope that clears it up for everybody that's out there.
So, you know, some years back we lost the denaturalization authority, we meaning Legacy INS and then DHS, to now denaturalization has to take place in district court.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, that's how a lot of the Nazi war criminals were nailed. In fact, I worked with some of the Nazi hunters way back when, gathering evidence for them and helping them out with a couple of those cases. And that's why immigration is so important. You know, so many people, when they hear immigration, their eyes roll. I wrote a commentary about my concerns about our southern border and the Iranians right now who have embedded themselves in Venezuela with the blessings of Hugo Chavez. What a piece of work Hugo Chavez is. And some guy said to me, well, Mr. Cutler, if there's a terrorist attack, immigration is going to be the least of our problems. And I said, no, actually, if there's a terrorist attack, it would be because of a failure, likely, of the immigration system, because that was exactly what we saw with 9/11. The fact that the aliens were able to enter the country and then embed themselves in our country led us back to why what you started to do started to happen. Because there was an understanding that developed that immigration was the pivotal issue. More than any other issue, it was the ability to enter our country and then hide in plain sight. And that's just how critically important immigration is. I don't think I'm going to get a disagreement from you on that one, Don.
No, not at all. And I think we're getting better at how to fix it, but there's some legislation that needs to take place.
If I gave you a magic wand, what would you do? Give me your top three, need a couple more. But let's start with the top three. If I gave you a magic wand and said, Don, have at it.
All right, I'll share that with you. Before I do, let me finish up to get an idea of the anti-fraud operation within CIS.
Okay.
Just in the past year alone, in fiscal year 11, we identified and followed up on over 14,000 leads, fraud leads, And we closed over 13,000 administrative fraud cases, just to give you an idea of a volume. And just to show you that most of the adjudicators know what they're looking for, 79% of the cases, this is the average, you know, across the board, the whole country, 79% of the referrals from adjudicators to FDNS resulted in a finding of fraud.
Well,
and when we first started this back in 2004 and 5, that percentage was well below 40% because everything was new. But because we've developed all the policies and procedures and the metrics and the systems and the priorities and we track it and all the training, we've now got up to just in the past year 79%. And it is now it's in the adjudicator work plans and it's built into the agency priorities. As far as the whole FDNS program. And now just going aside to the national security, just last year alone, we had over 3,000 national security hits of applicants seeking benefits. Now, about 25% of those were known or suspected terrorists, and it doesn't mean it's proven. They're at least identified for investigative and other purposes. And then the remaining were what we call non-known or suspected terrorist, which means there's some information, but not quite at the level of suspecting them to be a terrorist, but perhaps supporting or associated with things like that. So,
and you know what's so good about that, by the way, if you can knock them out of the box, even if they're not a terrorist, but you can show that they've committed fraud, and administratively you can remove them from the United States, you could certainly screw up plans that they might have had afoot, even if you can't prove that they did.
Exactly. And the fact that we're able to identify those cases now because of the very advanced screening that we do and background checks, it has led to even more FDNS officers being with the agency, the FBI.
How many people were there when you left?
Well, let's first start. My first year, we had four or five of us. The second year, they gave us 100 additional ones. The third year, another 100. And now the eighth year when I left, 780.
Now, 780. Now, tell my audience, how many applications for various immigration benefits are processed every year?
We get an average of between 6 and 7 million a year.
Boy, talk about Lucy at the Bonbon Factory.
Now, you got to really look at what the most fraud prone are. You look at, like we've been talking, marriage, asylum, employment-based. You know, you get rid of the kids and the, you know, the siblings.
Right, and you get rid of the brothers. Although you could have some fraud with the familial relationships.
And one day, you know, we're going to go from paper documents to support your claim relationship to DNA, and then we'll eliminate all that fraud.
Here's the other question I have. When I was part of that pilot program back in 1974, boy, it's hard to believe it was that long ago, we would actually go out and arrest the alien if they committed marriage fraud.
Mm-hmm.
That would become a locate case.
Right.
So even if we weren't prosecuting these folks, the alien would find himself on an airplane. Is that kind of effort being undertaken today? And I think I know what the answer is going to be in most cases. Probably not. Am I mistaken?
No.
And see, that's what bothers me, because I'll tell you how I see it, and I know what you're going to say, and I'll tell you the two things that really kind of bug me. And the point of it is that if you have a guy who gets a green card based on fraud and he gets away with it, we've still got this guy floating around out there, and nobody is physically looking for him. And
but
meanwhile,
I'll tell you what's different today, Michael, is the technology. So once you're identified, you know, it's going to be time because no one's really out there looking for you.
Right.
But a lookout's placed in techs, which used to be called the Treasury Enforcement
I'm familiar with
system.
That.
Now
right.
It's just techs. But all law enforcement intelligence agencies have access and use it. And we, you know, implemented a policy right after 911. Every applicant, petitioner, or beneficiary gets a tech check and all aliases. Okay.
All right, now here's my question for you. There's two questions that are coming. There's two questions that come to my mind now. Mm-hmm. Number one, if a guy is believed to have committed fraud and he got his green card and you realize that it and you've rescinded it, if he applies for a job and they use E-Verify, will that be flagged?
That's a good question. I don't know. I'm going to have to look into that.
See, now, I'll tell you what concerns me.
That's a very, very good question.
Because here you have a guy who maybe is involved with terrorism, maybe not, but you've got him floating around out there with a level of credibility he should not have because of that green card that he should not have been issued.
You know, I suspect not. And you know why? Because there has been a conscientious effort and concern to separate the verification aspects from the law enforcement aspect.
All right, so now what you're doing is strengthening my concern, because I'll tell you what my concern is. I got a call from somebody, and I confronted Mr. Chertoff about this at a working luncheon where he spoke and we ate, and I probably gave the poor guy indigestion afterwards. Because, you know, I don't mince words with this. As a New Yorker, the ashes from 9/11 landed on my home and in part contained the remains of some of my neighbors. But we're Americans, so it shouldn't matter if you're from Wyoming, New York, or Florida. But I got a call from an inspector, and he was beside himself. And he wouldn't tell me the person's name, and he should not, because it's need to know, and my top secret clearance had lapsed. But he had a guy come into his booth at a major port of entry with a U.S. passport that said he was born in Beirut, Lebanon. Now, for those of you out there that might not be familiar with this, when an alien naturalizes, that alien is entitled to take any name that he wants to take, and the day is sworn in. When they get a U.S. passport, the U.S. passport only reflects their new name. So in essence, we permit these folks to put themselves into their own witness protection program. So here's a guy that comes in, has an Anglo-sounding name. Let's pretend it's Robert Anderson. That sounds kind of Anglo to me. But he's looking at this guy. He has a heavy Arabic accent, says he's born in Beirut, and playing a hunch, he says, what was your name before you naturalized? And without thinking, the guy blurts out Muhammad whoever. He runs Muhammad whoever through the database. This guy is a wanted international terrorist. He was able to get on board airplanes. With that U.S. passport, he could have gotten a job at secure facilities. He could have worked on a military base. He could have been at an airport or a nuclear power plant or a food processing plant, which to me is critical infrastructure. You could certainly poison people if you work in one of those. Traveled all over Europe, Latin America, and the Middle East on a U.S. passport and basically what amounted to an assumed identity. See, one of the premises that you rely on, and I understand what you're saying, is that if somebody is now tagged as being suspected of fraud, anytime he shows up anywhere, they got him. Well, the State Department, and I don't know why they did this, and I'm not sure if they knew he was a terrorist when they issued the passport or not, gave this guy a passport with a fresh, clean identity. And I bet you that the countries that admitted him as, let's say, Robert Anderson, using the name that I know really wasn't his name, would never have admitted him if they knew him by the real name. And something as simple as adding a second name on a U.S. passport, according to Chertoff, was a political problem. And my goodness gracious, to stand there with the secretary or the former secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, the guy whose X-ray machines dose me every time I get on an airplane, explaining to me why it was a political problem to try to add a second name on a passport to secure not only our safety, but the safety of people around the world in allied countries, I have to tell you, leaves me underwhelmed. So it's not enough that we put the guy in the system. If the guy is still floating around out there with a green card or with a U.S. passport and can get a job wherever he wants, being treated like a resident alien or a U.S. citizen with no problems, gives me cause for pause.
Right.
I hope I make sense to you, Don.
You do. Want to talk about my wand now?
Go ahead.
All right, we got a few minutes.
Yes.
First, let's talk about what's the magnet? What draws people to the United States? What draws them to overstay their visit and stay?
Most of them, it's a job. Not all, but
it's
most.
It's a job. It's employment. So I would say the historical antiquated thinking has been give the agencies more money for their operations, hire more people, go chase these people down. Even though you don't have enough jails to put them in, you don't have enough planes to put them in the countries, don't issue all the travel documents. It's loaded with issues. Build a system that is innate. In itself is, in a great part, self-enforcing. So you mandate employers to use E-Verify. You make every employer who's going to hire a foreign national use a system that they document that they've – that others, including all the lawful workers, have had an opportunity to apply for their jobs. It's all tracked. It's all automated. You make every employer have to update the system when these people report, if they don't have the experience, when they leave their jobs. And if they don't, you have serious penalties, and that can lead up to imprisonment, perhaps even losing their authority and their licenses to be an employer in the United States. I would also modify the removal proceedings, because while I'm not a lawyer, I'm not aware of the Constitution or any other legal requirement that an alien who entered this country illegally or overstayed their visit is entitled to full due process, to include an extremely expensive and labor and time-consuming administrative removal process. We're our own worst enemies. We just create our own problems. So I look at what ICE is doing in prioritizing the criminal aliens, the national security threats. They should be the individuals that, if you want formal orders, or perhaps individuals that have some other fear of persecution or some exemption or waiver because of some extreme hardship. But other than those, your typical illegal alien that crossed the border illegally or overstayed their visit, once you find them, they're deportable, and it's expeditious, and you get them out of here if you can. But you got to have that magnet weaken where it's hard to find a job. The recent stats I've seen is that because of the state of the economy, which is, if there's anything good about the economy, and I hate to say this, it's that there aren't as many jobs. So there's less aliens entering the country illegally.
I don't buy that.
Because, okay, well, there's stats on all this.
No,
and,
I know, but let me say that why it's flawed. I had this discussion with Neil Cavuto when I was on his program. They're basing it on Border Patrol arrests. And when you realize the way that the Border Patrol has been frankly intimidated by the administration, I'm trying to remember the name of the most recent Border Patrol agent victimized by DOJ, the guy that was accused of lifting the handcuffs of a guy that was caught with hundreds of thousands of dollars of drugs, and the guy was struggling with him. He was accused, and I believe from everything I've read that it was wrong. They accused him of violating his civil rights, and he's doing 2 years in jail now. So you have Border Patrol agents reluctant to make arrests. They're trying to figure out how many illegals are here based on people being arrested, as I said on Neil Cavuto. It's kind of like taking attendance and asking the people to raise their hand if they're not present.
Yeah.
So I don't buy that.
Okay. But
if you look at the violence in Mexico, I'll tell you what, I wouldn't care if I had a job or I didn't have a job. I would do anything I could to get out of Mexico. 45,000 people killed since Felipe Calderon took office. So I don't know that I buy that. But here's my problem with all of this, and this is something that we have to anticipate. We, number one, do not go after the aliens who are working illegally. They have silent raids. I just did a congressional hearing about the silent raids last year, which means the employer gets nailed, the employee does not. And now you add to that, if you did go after the illegal alien employees, then you're simply propelling them in the direction of committing more fraud, because that's where they're going to go. As I said a long time ago at a hearing, if you squeeze a balloon, it bulges elsewhere. If you made it impossible for illegals to work in the United States, then they'd look to become legal.
But there is no magic pill.
No, it's got to be a coordinated effort. And
right,
the efforts you've made are important, and I agree with what you were trying to accomplish. But when the stakes are so high, I'll be honest, I always see the glass half empty, because we know that it doesn't take much for us to get attacked because we are so vulnerable.
Well, part of the problem with being half empty all the time or extremely conservative is we are never able to reach a practical compromise. But I'm not going to go down that path. But you asked me what I would do. So would you at least
go ahead. I'm sorry, Don.
Okay. All right, no problem. All right, so you got to fix the magnet. You address the magnet. You hit the employers. You make them use E-Verify. You make it harder to get a job. Also, you require all people who are coming to this country and people who are already here applying for an extension of their visa or a change of their visa to come in and have their biometrics collected and their biographical information and have criminal and national security checks done and entered into the arrival departure database and U.S. visit, so that it becomes harder to get in without being identified and tracked, harder to travel within,
yep.
It becomes harder to get a job. You can't beat the system and get in deportation proceedings because most of you aren't entitled to that, so that if you're physically caught, you can be removed quickly, that ICE could just buy a ticket and you're out of here, and you are in the circle is starting to enclose. And
no, I agree with you on that one. And, in fact, I'll tell you what I would love to see if you are an alien who's deportable because of a criminal violation, you've done time for narcotics or rape or arson, you should be immediately removed, and you can file your appeal from your home country, as far as I'm concerned.
Yes. This issue about marriages. You know, there's a provision to apply for a waiver if you're no longer living together after 2 years. Well, congressional intent was, if you're no longer living together after a couple years, leave. And if you can establish a hardship, you can apply for a waiver. Well, it's just maybe it's me, but if they're no longer married and they don't even have any children,
then why are they still here?
Family unit. The whole purpose is family unification. Why should there be a waiver to stay?
And that's like the VAWA case, the Violence Against Women's Act. And you have Americans, I am certain, being charged with violating the spouse, when in point of fact it's probably fraud. I helped an attorney with a case like that, where it was simply an alien trying to game the system, and it falsely accused her husband of assaulting her. And the guy got locked up.
Yeah, well, you know, it's like no matter what kind of program there is, you're going to have a certain amount of fraud. That was
a little
trickier.
You're right that we should be focused on the whole idea. We brought the alien here for the benefit of the United States citizen, not the other way around.
Yeah, you brought him here for unification.
Yeah.
And if there isn't no family, there's no reason to stay. Now, the ones that have been abused, that's a little harder because what they tried to do there is at least allow provision for foreigners to come into the country based on a marriage to only find themselves get abused, and we know that happens. I mean,
so
we
put
know
this, put the American in jail if that's the case.
Exactly, but if there's no mechanism, for example, if the alien's thinking, well, if I report them, I got to go home. Now, some may say, well, tough, that's the way it is, but that's the thing. If the mere reporting of that separation is going to result in that person having to return to their country, they're likely to take the abuse, which could eventually lead to their death. And no one wants that. So,
no,
I
agree with, but I just worry about the other side of it, where the alien is savvy enough to know that the trick here is to self-petition by accusing the spouse of
yes.
And
we have
them.
To outsmart them. We have to be savvier, if you will,
yeah,
to try to
do.
Be able to weed out and identify those cases.
Yeah, absolutely, because, again, I don't want Americans getting victimized by the system.
Exactly.
You know, Doris Meisner used to say that we should be in the business of being customer-oriented. I agreed, but I think Doris and I disagreed about who the customer was. I've always believed the customers were the U.S. citizens.
Well, I think we're all stakeholders and customers to a certain degree, but we have various levels of entitlements, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we went through that whole era with the other administration that even enforcement had customers, and it was pretty hard for enforcement types to look at the detainees and prisoners as, you're my customer. But
well, now they call
them
stakeholders. Is that any better?
Yeah, we go through all these different terms. Most of them are politically induced to be friendlier and nicer and all those things. But, you know, you work with them, you do the best you can, and you really focus on your mission.
And you try. And believe me, I know you had a daunting task. And if I sound critical, it's not critical of you, but it is critical of what we're not doing, because I still see vulnerabilities. And those vulnerabilities keep me awake at night.
You know, absolutely. And but I tell you what, though, when I look over the span of my 36-year career, to look at where we were and where we are and then where we're going, especially with the technology that's available, and government doesn't do a real good job developing systems or having them developed.
I sometimes think we get too caught up
there.
In the technology. Now, the biometrics I agree with. You're going to be surprised or maybe not, but the very first hearing I did for Congress back in May of 97, I was told I was the first person to raise the issue about the need for biometrics being an integral part of everything we did. And that's what led to the Raytheon contract, where we started to do the initial fingerprinting by the Border Patrol. This was around the time of Resendez Ramirez, the railway killer.
Yeah, no, I remember all that.
So I agree with it, but sometimes good old-fashioned manpower is the solution. I would rather have manned helicopters, for example, than drones on the border.
Think about it, Michael. Think about being an agent where you actually have enough manpower and resources to focus on the real cases, and that all the rest is being taken care of either electronically or whatever. Now, let me just share a few things we're working on with a new analytics-based system. you know, before everything's paper, it's antiquated. They can claim to have this many kids, and here's their names, and this is their relatives, this is where they live, they're married, they're divorced, they worked here, they got this academic record. They can claim all that. But we now have our building capabilities that the system, through the business rules that we've identified, will be able to say, hey, wait a minute. This person, we've got a record over here of that address with these people. Hey, we've got a record. This person's already filed 2 marriage petitions.
Right.
Hey, this person already filed 4 applications to report their reportedly lost and stolen green card.
Oh, I agree. Look, that's a big problem.
This person claimed to have been unmarried when they come in 5 years ago, but now they're saying they were married.
Right. No,
all
I understand. You're able to cross-reference everything,
identify.
And that's phenomenal.
It's going to be great.
But again, I still think at the end of the day, you still need the manpower.
Plus, all fraud leads, all national security, all fraud cases bounced against every filed application. I mean, this is going to be remarkable. I wish I was still with the agency to be able to truly enjoy the fruits of our labor.
Well, you know, we've all made the steps, I think, to get things in the direction they need to go. But at the end of the day, I wish they gave us as much manpower at immigration as they did the TSA, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, really and truly, I certainly don't want to ever wind up with a window seat on a de facto cruise missile. I do a lot of flying. But on the other hand, that's not the only threat that we face. And the fact that we have 7,000 ICE agents and 700-odd investigators over at your old shop is a drop in the bucket, again, when you consider it's kind of like standing in front of Niagara Falls with an 8-ounce glass trying to catch all the water going by.
Well, if I'm at the bottom looking up, I don't care what kind of size glass you give me. I'm in deep trouble.
Yeah, you certainly are. Isn't that where they are today? What an image. Maybe we should be handing out water wings. There's an image. Every agent gets a rubber ducky. God help us. You know, if we lose our sense of humor, our minds can't be far behind.
That's true.
Don Crescenti,
well,
I got to tell you, it is always delightful having conversations with you. I hope you'll come back and join me again on the program.
I look forward to it.
You know, if I sound like I'm being tough on you, I'm not, but I am being tough on our country.
It's fine. I really enjoy it.
Good. Well, I did also. You know, I do a lot of speaking engagements. I'm heading to D.C. in a couple of weeks, and I was in front of a bunch of Air Force generals and colonels not too long ago, and I said to them, why do we still have a military? And boy, I thought they wanted to lynch me. And I said, before you guys go for your sidearms, I'm not wearing Kevlar today. Here's my point. If we have a border that lacks security, and if we have millions of people inside our country, and we don't know who they are, where they're from, or why they're here, how can you accomplish your primary mission of keeping our enemies as far from our shores as possible? And one of the generals came up to me after my presentation, and he said, you know, Mr. Cutler, I got to tell you, you reminded me today of just how pissed I am at my own government. I'm going to be writing letters tonight. And that's what I urge everybody out there to do. You know, I certainly don't think anyone could argue that Don Crescenti wasn't trying to do the best job he could do with the limited resources that he was given. I was only a field agent, not a district director, and a district director today would be a SAC, special agent in charge. But I don't think anyone would argue that Mike Cutler didn't try to give the taxpayers a run for their money when he went on duty every day. I certainly tried my darndest because I always remember that I was also a taxpayer. But at the end of the day, if we don't get leadership in Washington so that we stop playing these games, because they are games, then we're still going to be in trouble. You know, I've made the point before, I will make it again. With all the talk about creating jobs takes time. There's lag time. People have to invest money to build the buildings and build the facilities and all this other business. You could liberate jobs and put Americans to work tomorrow morning by getting illegal aliens out of the workplace. And when people say, well, you're anti-immigrant, no. The difference between an immigrant and an illegal alien is comparable to the difference between a house guest and a burglar. And if you are here in violation of law, then you should have no right to remain here and no expectation that you will be able to remain here. And until that equation changes, no matter how hard the folks at Don's old shop work, no matter how hard the folks at ICE work, without the backing and the resources of the powers that be, we're going to be spinning our wheels. Because when I can look at the newspaper reports where there are, and we may disagree on this, Don, but I certainly don't believe we have 12 million. I think we have about 30 million illegals in our country. Then you have to ask yourself what it is that we're doing to protect American jobs. Because, you know, the Labor Department used to run immigration out of a concern for American jobs. And you add to it national security and the problem with the drug cartels and Iranians in Venezuela. And I look at that whole mess, and nobody could possibly walk away from that and say, well, we've done enough where immigration is concerned. We've done enough where border security is concerned. So what I ask all of you folks out there is, if it upsets you and torques you and keeps you awake as it does me, and I suspect it keeps Don awake, I don't want to speak for him, but I wouldn't be surprised, then we've got to be the best citizens we can be and make certain that we reach out to our elected representatives and let them know about our concerns and our frustrations. Any argument, Don?
No, none.
So, you know, I think we're on the same page. We want to, you know, honor those who come here legally. My own mother was an immigrant, you know. But it's about making certain that we don't open that door, we don't give the key to somebody who would do harm to us one way or the other. And that's why the fraud issue is so important. That's why I was excited to have you on the program today, because you know, I'm a great believer in the mission you were trying to accomplish. But I think we need to do more in that direction. I think there needs to be enough manpower. If they could have 60,000 people groping 85-year-old women at airports, then we could have more than 7,000 ICE agents, half of whom are doing customs work. And by the way, when there's a political campaign like right now, most of those agents are working with Secret Service to protect the presidential candidates. So you know that immigration casework is going out the window altogether. That's not acceptable in my world, and I'm willing to bet that you would agree that we need the resources there, Don, so that the rubber does meet the road.
Always need the resources, but I think we need to apply them, you know, more smartly.
Well, we do, but I there's something to be said for random, and there's something to be said for tripping over people. You'd be amazed at the people I bumped into simply by doing my job. Do you know half the FBI's 10 most wanted? You know how they get arrested? By being stopped at a motor vehicle checkpoint, or because the guy runs a red light, or he's speeding. It's remarkable what happens if you're out there in the routine business of doing law enforcement, who you're going to encounter, what you're going to find, what you're going to see. So many terrorists, so many bad guys, so many wanted individuals are popped, arrested, purely because they were in the wrong place for them at the wrong time, and it turned out to have been the right place for us. And that's what's so critical. I keep thinking back to that first terrorist plot that I worked on back in 1976, where we prevented an attack in Israel, all by dumb luck. Some guy with an altered visa, and he kept referring to Israel as Palestine and said a couple of other things to me that got the antenna up. And I followed the hunch, and the hunch eventually led us to a major terrorist attack. And it was an eye-opener for me. Because what it taught me, and this was the lesson that stayed with me for my 26 years as an agent. I had 30 years in altogether with the INS. But for those 26 years, I always chased my hunches. And very often, they really panned out. But it's like the lottery. You know, you got to be in it to win it. And we can't entirely rely on technology. Technology is important, no argument. But at the end of the day, just like we've seen with espionage, you can get so much intelligence out of the satellites and out of all kinds of high-tech stuff, but at the end of the day, it's that informant that walks in and hands you that key piece of information that can make all the difference in the world.
Yeah.
So there's got to be a balance. I agree with technology, but I'm also a great believer in what flesh and blood can accomplish. As I started to say before, you know, all this reliance on drones. Drones cost four times what a helicopter costs. I'd rather put helicopters up there with Border Patrol agents in it who can immediately land and assist a fellow Border Patrol agent who might find himself surrounded.
You're absolutely
just
right.
Take pictures. I'm sorry?
In fact, the way I've been communicating it within our agency is the three critical things that have to happen for us to succeed and truly instilling integrity in our legal immigration system, which equates to also protecting national security, because if you have a system that's being abused, the country is at risk. But there are three things that have to absolutely happen, and this is where FDNS has concentrated its strategy. The one thing is you need an operation. The operation is more reactive than proactive, but you've got to have the boots on the ground and the butts in the seats to detect and pursue and conduct the investigations and to do a number of other operational things. So you got to feed your operation, you got to train them, you got to have the right tools. The second thing is that you've got to have the right data and analysis taking place so that you really got a good handle on your problems, on the types of fraud, on the causes, the root causes. You've got to have that data to include the types of criminal hits you're getting, national security, what kind of threats, how they're getting in. You need all this data that can guide you accordingly as to whether you need to pursue legislative solutions, regulatory, it's just internal policy and procedure, it's poor performance. You need that data. And then the third thing is using that operational activity information, using the data from your analyses, you then use the technology to build whatever systems you can to provide the better tool to support the accomplishment of the operation. And also be looking at what you can do electronically to help have self enforcement and deterrence and all those things. So
yes, but I'll tell you the one thing though. At the end
of
the day,
success.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, if you have an administration that says we're going to give employment authorization to illegal aliens, we're going to have silent raids, we're going to do whatever we can so that, you know, to quote what was written in an interesting article, you know, the game isn't over till the alien wins. That isn't the way that we're going to get the job done. You know, there's a wonderful Yiddish expression that translated says that when the fish goes bad, it smells from the head. If we're going to have an administration in place that winks and blinks at violations of immigration laws, that nothing that you're talking about is going to happen. When you can have
right.
sanctuary
well,
cities.
Well, you've got to change existing laws because the
no,
way.
No, but wait a moment. Wait a moment. In all fairness and reasonableness, when you have sanctuary cities that harbor, aid, abet, shield, and encourage illegal aliens, they're committing felonies and getting away with it. And yet when you have states like Arizona and Alabama attempting to pass laws to fill the void created by the federal government's failures and they get sued, there's something wrong with the equation. As far as I'm concerned, if you are a local law enforcement official and you don't honor an ICE detainer, you should be getting arrested and charged federally with violating federal law. It's not happening.
Well, let me ask you a question as a former agent. Do
yep.
you agree with the 287G authority as far as state and locals enforcing immigration laws?
As long as they're properly trained, absolutely, sure. Absolutely. I have no problem with that. You know, it's a funny thing because people keep saying, oh, it's federal law. The FBI has authority to go after kidnappers and bank robbers, so do local cops. You see this across the board. And when people say things like, I heard this argument, well, you know, you can't have this crazy patchwork quilt of Alabama enforcing one set of law and South Carolina another one. My answer is, why not? We do it with firearms. We do it with driver's licenses. We do it with taxes. We do it with environmental standards and labor standards. You go from state to state, lots of things change. And
well,
America survives. And I think immigration laws are clear. They're not establishing policy. All they're doing is making a determination if the guy should be arrested. And we hear these nonsense arguments that we heard community policing.
Now. That's not quite the extent of 287G. Now, maybe,
No. I'm talking about the local but even on the local laws that are being enacted.
Well,
my point is that as long as they're consistent with federal law and we enroll and enlist the assistance of the local police, I think it's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
But
now,
we've
got
to have the manpower to
that.
Respond when they make that phone call and say we've got a suspected illegal alien in custody.
Right. Well, that's not quite 287G that I was talking about. But my point in this, and you just heard me talk for over an hour, so I think you know that I'm very serious when it comes to enforcement.
Oh, no, I know you are. But all I'm saying is we're being undermined by the political establishment.
Yeah.
That's my
point. I know. And that's why earlier I think I made some reference to, and that's why you said, if you were given the magic wand. I mean, let's face it, in our political environment, and it's not just in the past few years.
No, it's not one party or the other.
Person,
it's both sides of the aisle. Let's be real fair about this.
For every person that wants, you know, that's conservative and wants the immigration laws enforced, there's a person that doesn't. And there's a person, it's okay until it's somebody they know.
Well, but you know, I got to tell you. I have to tell
you
I'm not even
a
conservative. I'm a lifelong Democrat.
In today's world, I don't know if Congress could ever possibly reach an agreement on most of the things that we've talked about.
Well, let me tell you real quickly, because we are running out of time, but I'll tell you this real quickly. When I hear this nonsense that it's anti-immigrant to enforce the immigration laws, anyone that says that needs to go for rhinoplasty. Their nose is growing. Because the most likely victim of transnational gangs are the members of the immigrant community and the ethnic communities, whether it's the Mexican community, whether it's the Russian community, the Asian community. I was part of the drug task force. The violence that I saw carried out in those communities by these thugs who never should have been here. And most of the people that were killed or extorted or injured were immigrants. And if you look at it from that angle and you realize that the illegal aliens coming in are taking these jobs and all the harm that's being done, it's pro-immigrant to enforce those very same laws. And then the lie is, oh, well, the immigrants won't, or the Latino community won't vote for anybody who wants secure borders. They want the Dream Act. No, they don't. Wherever I've gone, and if I've had a one-on-one conversation with people, in fact, it happened today in a local store that I go to frequently, the two ladies who work in the shop are Mexicans originally. They're now Americans, and they've told me they've heard me on TV many times, and they agree with everything I've said. They are upset that we don't secure the borders. They're upset that Mexico has become a free fire zone. She was telling me today, this one lady, you can't go to a nightclub in Mexico for fear that if you walk into a nightclub, some guy with a machine gun is going to walk in and start spraying bullets. So this is the kind of violence we're trying to prevent. And it's about enforcing immigration laws so that we don't descend into the hell of a Mexico. And if you have politicians who keep looking for cheap labor or keep looking for people to make campaign contributions, you know, you and I were not allowed to take a cup of coffee when we were on duty. And these guys take money with both hands and brag about it. Could you imagine if you were my district director and I went to you and said, Don, you should be proud of me. I'm the best fundraiser in the office. How do you think you would have reacted to that? Need I say more?
And I call the OIG.
Need I say more? I mean, how wacky is that? You can't make this stuff up, can you?
No, it is hard to make. You couldn't make it up.
No, I mean, it's the Twilight Zone, and I decided after 9/11 that I had enough BS, and I was going to go out there and call them as I see them, and if I step on some toes, that's okay. People can wear steel-toe boots around me or take the pain. You know, it's one way or the other. But I think these issues are too damn important to pussyfoot around them, and I think we've got to confront these issues, and we've got to be honest about it, and that's been my goal. That's why I do this program. To try to get that perspective out there that you're probably not going to hear too many places. Is that reasonable enough to you?
I certainly understand it.
And I'm sure that you share my frustrations.
Yes, but I guess having been in it so long, I tend to know what's practical and what's realistic, and I don't
I think I know what's practical and realistic, but I think we're looking at it differently. And in all fairness, I know you were a district director, and I know you ran that place, and you did a great job, but the agent perspective is different, and I don't believe you went out there and made the criminal cases and then saw the impact in the real world when you were locking these people up. And that really gives you a very different perspective. When you know somebody is on the run and he did some terrible crimes, my last significant arrest was a guy wanted for murder in the first degree in Chicago. Not only did I arrest this piece of work, but I was told by the sentencing judge in Chicago that it was my testimony that convinced him to sentence him to life without parole. So when you realize what can happen in the real world, I testified at a murder trial of a guy that I had physically deported, came back, NYPD, turned him loose twice. And the third time, he was arrested by Officer Machete, or at least he tried to arrest him. The guy got Machete's gun. Bullets flew. Officer Machete was killed, age 24, and his wife was pregnant with a daughter he would never meet. So when you see stuff like that happen, Don, let me tell you, you add to that 9/11 and all the other things I've seen in 30 years on the street, it has a profound impact on the way you see the world. And, in fact, I met Officer Machete's daughter by accident. I was in the supermarket. And here was this very pretty young lady bagging groceries. You know, she was a checkout gal working temporarily. She was a college student. And I saw her wear one of those little badges. I don't know who she was. And I said, who's the cop? She said, my dad. I said, where does he work? She said, oh, he doesn't. He died. But she had no emotion. And I said, boy, a long time ago? She said, he died before I was born. And suddenly it clicked. I said, is your name Machete? And she freaked out. Can you imagine? So this has a real-world impact, folks, and that's why we do this. Anyway, I'm going to wrap up. Don Crescetti, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. Ladies and gentlemen out there, I thank you for spending the past nearly hour and a half looking at the clock with us. I hope you found the program today to be interesting, and I don't know that the word entertaining is appropriate, but certainly I hope it's been eye-opening. And if, again, you feel motivated by what you heard tonight, get involved. Make those phone calls. Write those letters. As I always like to say when I'm signing off, democracy is certainly not a spectator sport. And then please take that to heart, folks. Become involved. Take your citizenship seriously. This is Mike Cutler signing off. Don Crescetti, good to talk to you, my friend. Be well.
Thank you, everyone.
Hello there.
Yes, hello.
Hello, is this Michael Cutler?
Yes, it is. Who's this?
Oh, great. My name is Glenn. I was listening to your show, and this is the first time I've ever listened to your show, and I think it's awesome.
Well, thank you so much. I'm sorry I couldn't take your call, but I wanted to spend time with my guest today, but I appreciate the call. So forgive me for not getting to you sooner.
Oh, no problem. It was entertaining in a lot of ways. I'm glad you didn't take any calls because I wanted to hear both of you. That was great.
Well, you know, and you can see I don't mince words. Where I agree with Don, I agree with him, and where I don't agree with him, you're going to know when I don't agree with you.
I think it's amazing what you're doing. I really do. I respect everything. You know, you've worked for 30 years doing this, and I tell you, it's an ongoing battle, isn't it? Oh, boy.
It is. What's your name? I'm sorry.
My name is Glenn Askinson.
Glenn?
Yes, Glenn.
Okay, Glenn. You know, if you go to my website, if you want, you can shoot me an email through my website, and I can put you on my list so you'll know when I do programs and you'll get my commentaries and all that.
Well, what I was going to ask you was I have a situation that's kind of on the other end of the spectrum here.
Okay.
I am Canadian, and I'm in Texas, and I have a situation where I was unlawfully detained in Folsom Prison Immigration Law Detention Center.
Right.
I have
say this again. Run this by me again. Tell me again what you said, Glenn.
Oh, sorry. I'm Canadian.
Right.
Originally, and I've come across. I just wanted to let you know that. It's an ongoing story that I have, and if you have time or whenever you have time, I'd like to speak with you more in depth about it. I don't know if you have a lot of other callers, but I would really like to express my situation to you. Because I was unlawfully detained and falsified inside an immigration detention center for 90 days.
Wow.
And
I don't know how I could help.
Well, just one sec. Sorry. What happened?
Let me call you back, Glenn. Okay.
Okay.
I'll call you right back.
Do you have my number?
Yes, I do.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
I'll call you back. All right. Thanks. Bye.
Okay. Bye. Bye.